So yeah, it's I don't know. I'll probably die studying flies. It's still flies. It has always been flies. And what I'm going to talk about today is something more specific, which is how do you do computation on natural signals if you're a fly? How should you do computations on natural signals if you're a fly? And does the stuff we see happening in motion-sensitive cells in the fly visual system make any sense in that big scheme of, in the big question of how to calculate interesting information from neural input in a natural environment? So a lot of the work was done with Bill and Jeff Lewin, who did a lot of the experiments and a lot of the development of the gadgets that you'll see. Just one practical question. Is that too light? Should we dim it a little? Oh, okay. So there are a lot of good reasons to study flies, and that's one of, well, that's why I'm still doing it, maybe. And the grand old man of neuroanatomy had a very strong opinion about that. He said, sorry, Peter, that with the retina of the bird or the higher mammal appears something coarse, rude, and deplorably elementary if you compare it to the insect retina. So I'll live by that. And you can prove that he's wrong at some point, but I thought it was a fun quote here. Just to introduce you to the animal that we're studying here, it's the blowfly. It's one of those big flies that fly out to the window, try to get out on hot summer's days and make all this bzzz noise. That's these. So there are other flies which are, well, fruit flies are very famous, of course, for their genetics. And then there's an in-between size fly, which is the house fly, which are the ones that always circle around you and land on you, the real nasty ones. So these are relatively benign. What many people don't know, they're very surprised, is that insects have brains. And this proves it, I guess. This is a kind of home-mount picture by Nick Strausfeld from a big book called Atlas of an Insect Brain, and that's all about the brain of the fly. So the brain of the fly consists of a number of distinguishable big lobes called lamina medulla and the lobular complex. That part of the brain, those three big lobes, are all devoted to visual information processing. And as you could have guessed from this outside picture already, visual information seems to be very important for the fly. I mean, there's a lot of surface area of the head is devoted to getting visual input. For this type of fly, this species, Calliphora vicina, it takes information through each eye through 5,000 little lenses. And so you can think of this as information, all the visual information that's coming into the fly visual system consists of 5,000 measurements per eye, so 10,000 measurements altogether, 10,000 pixels that this visual system is scanning. And from that, all its visual computation have to take place. So that's the starting point. So one thing that flies do is live up to the name. They fly, of course. One interesting piece of behavior that's especially exhibited by the male, which is the red fly in this diagram, is that they sit on a leaf and watch the sky with essentially with this part of their eyes, which is looking kind of upward, and they wait until a nice juicy dark spot comes by, hope that it's a female, and try to chase it in order to make more flies ultimately. Or the other thing is that they're territorial also, so it could also be another male fly that it wants to chase away. So this red fly has caught sight of this blue fly here and is trying to capture it. The blue fly makes, well, it looks like evading maneuvers. We're not sure, of course. And the red fly is trying to follow it. So the blue fly makes a turn here. The red fly makes a turn as well, but a little later, overshoots. Tries to catch up here again. The blue fly makes a very quick turn, and the red fly goes off to the wrong direction, but then quickly realizes that and turns around again, tries to catch up here again, and again bangs his head almost. And then you get this beautiful loop. The blue fly, and the red fly does that too, and then winds up. And so this one disappeared from the genetic pool, but might have more success on another occasion. We just don't know. The point here is that flies do a lot of acrobatics during flight. They're very fast flyers. And a lot of the, a lot of the information that's needed for tracking the leading fly is provided by the visual system. There's just no other sense organ that can do that. Also, and that's going to be really more the focus of this talk, in order even to do that, in order to fly in a stable way, the fly has to have a very good control system in order not to crash. So even underlying this behavior and trying to catch up with the leading fly, there's a problem of just staying aloft in a stable way. In order to do that, you need, as I said, a good control system. The control system needs input from sense organs, and one of the important sense organs for that, for flight stabilization, is also the visual system. There's also another more mechanosensory system related to the wings of the fly that also plays an important role in flight stabilization, but visual input is certainly also very important. And later on in the talk, I'll show you examples of recordings from cells that encode this kind of motion, this kind of rotational motion. Well, I should backtrack a little bit. These cells encode really how fast the fly is rotating along its vertical axis. So it's encoding yaw. In airplane terms. Another feature of this is that this takes place on a very fast time scale. So this behavior is very fast. Colin Land, who studied these flies, estimate that the response of the chasing fly to changes in course of the leading fly has a lag of about 30 milliseconds. And so that 30 milliseconds includes vision, visual transduction, includes neurocomputation, and the first onset of behavioral response to that stimulus. So 30 milliseconds is roughly, you can think of that as the minimum decision time that the fly has, or the minimum response time that the fly has to an external stimulus while it's in flight. So it's very fast. That means that flies also turn very fast. They make rapid turns of thousands of degrees per second easily. So they're really, really fast flyers.
So yeah. How can I be sure that the male fly doesn't pull?
Sorry, that the?
Doesn't pull out factory. It doesn't pull out factory.
I guess you can never be completely sure, but to do this in about, this is 0.8 seconds or so, and follow a trail, I mean, I don't think, I have a hard time imagining that olfaction, that this guy could sense by olfaction the path of that fly when it's even not there. I mean, the fusion is just too slow for that. So. Yeah, but the directional information on the antenna is not that great, I would think. And it's contaminated by how the wind blows. So I'd have a hard time imagining that. And yes, that's true. They'll also, if you sit there, and we actually did that in the outdoors experiment that I showed you as a kind of calibration, that if you sit there doing an outdoor experiment, we'll get to that later, and you look at the other flies that sit around, and you throw a little stone in, well, kind of the trajectory of the female, then they'll chase that also.
So how does it tell the
male? Oh, I think that's probably olfactory, or there may be other cues. Do you know that, Simon? Right, but then at some point when they capture it, then
they have to be contact.
Then they'll have
same sex. They yeah.
So then there's other stuff that certainly plays a role.
If you're competing with other male plants, they then chase just to go after it.
Right. Well, I presume they'll go after other species too. I mean, if they go after little stones or peas, then other species will. So, and at some point in that chase, they'll notice that it's the wrong species. And I'm not sure if that's they need real physical contact for that, or do you know that?
Well, what Collett and Mann showed was that they assume that any small black target is a fly, even with the characteristic velocity of their own species.
Right.
And then at some stage, it no longer computes something, and so they give up, and nobody knows how they make the decision to give up.
But there's.
Again, if you're competing with other people, clients, then it's a good idea just to assume not to be an outlier, go for it.
And go for it and then see, well,
and then see what happens.
Yeah.
So okay. They don't run into dragonflies too often?
That, I presume they could detect a dragonfly at a safe distance, yeah. Okay, so visual information processing is very fast in these animals. It serves a very important function just to stay in the air while flying. And a lot of the brain, about two-thirds of the nerve cells in the brain, in the total brain, is devoted to visual information processing. So just like us, we are very visual animals too. We have a big chunk of our brain devoted to visual information processing. Okay, so this is not an easy problem. I mean, you have to calculate all kinds of things that you're interested in, motion in this case, from an input. And it's always good if you do a science talk to refer back to the canon of Western philosophy. And so I thought that in this case, I'd show this is kind of the Platonic ideal form of the fly swatting woman. This is, of course, from Gerrit Larson. This is the Platonic ideal that lives kind of outside the cave, and the fly sits just like us, it's chained in a cave, and it sees only kind of murky reflections of what this ideal form is. The first physical reason for that is that visual information is carried by photons, so there's a photon stream. And this is meant to kind of, well, the white little dots are meant to represent photon counts. And this, I've calculated this to be roughly the photon counts in a decision time, 30 milliseconds for a fly, sitting in a room that's, well, roughly about this light, so not too bright. So you can see that there's still certainly a reflection of that ideal form in the photon flux. But of course, the problem has gotten harder. On top of that, the fly has to project these light rays onto its cells, and it does that onto its photoreceptor cells, and it does that, of course, through optics. And the optics consists of small lenses which have noticeable diffraction. So diffraction effects are about they smear the image by about a degree of visual angle. And then finally, this whole noisy and blurred pattern is sampled by a raster, discrete raster of photoreceptors in a kind of hexagonal arrangement. And so that is the raw visual input that you get in about a 30 millisecond snapshot. Now, you could think, if you're a fly, you're sitting on the table and she's standing there, that you might just start integrating, and if you integrate over a long time, of course, you get a very good representation, maybe, of the ideal form. Of course, in real life, that's not something you can do because there's motion. So things in the real world move, and you have to make decisions on the spot whether to fly away or not, and where to fly to. And again, this is the ideal form, but in real life, you get something like that. So these are then snapshots, 30 milliseconds at a rather moderate light intensity like here. Yeah, that's potentially true, yes. I'm talking here just about the visual problem. But the air movement, and for example, cockroaches are very good at that. They can detect air movements and run away in that way. And flies do have mechanosensory hairs. They don't have this circle system that cockroaches have. So I don't know really how good they are at that. But I'm talking here, of course, exclusively about the visual input. Yeah, it's going to get bigger in the visual field, yes. But it also moves fast, so it's well. And I guess the proof of the pudding is that fly swats are being sold and they work. Yeah. So <it's>, sometimes. Okay, so the problem is that you have to go from a raw data stream in multiple dimensions, noisy, etc., to the extraction of features that you're interested in. So how would that work? So the raw sensory input, in some sense, implicitly contains these features. And you have to extract them by doing some kind of suitable computation. So if we want to make sense of neural signals, which we are going to try and do in a couple of slides away from here, we have to realize that the input signals that the system works with are ambiguous, noisy, complex. Also, it's seldomly clear, I mean, in general, in neurophysiology, if you stick an electrode in a brain and you get some spikes on that electrode, it's seldomly clear what feature is really computed there. What do these spikes represent? That's a difficult problem in general, if you want to be exact about that. And certainly in the case of the visual system, the input space is a very high dimensional space. So you have 5,000 pixels per eye, which in principle all acts as independent light sensors. So you have, in principle, in your mathematical version of the problem, at least you have 5,000 dimensions per eye. And then each of those pixels measures light intensities with a correlation time of the order of 10 milliseconds or so. So you get per second, you get 100 roughly independent samples. So that means that the problem is not that easy. You have a very high dimensional spatiotemporal input signal from which you have to extract features, and you have to do that more or less in real time, because you want to respond to the fly swat or you want to respond to coarse deviations. Now, in the case of the fly, we're lucky. We can simplify a lot of these potentially very difficult problems. The first one is that we're able to measure the response of fly photoreceptors, and we can characterize quantitatively their signal and noise. And I've actually learned to do that in Simon's lab a long time ago, and that has been very useful, because if you know what a single fly photoreceptor does in terms of signal and noise, you have a good idea of what the limitations to visual computation can be in that system. We also have a good guess for the function. If you want to calculate something related to motion, if you're in flight, you presumably want to calculate something like rotational velocity. So that, for now, is going to be an educated guess, and later on, I'll try to convince you that the fly might really want to do this. But for now, it's probably a good guess. Then we can also reduce the dimensionality of the problem, and that's a very important one for the subsequent analysis. If you think about more complicated tasks, such as face recognition or so, it's not clear how you can reduce the dimensionality of that problem to something manageable. In the case of motion detection, we can, and we can actually, experimentally assess that the fly does this computation mainly or almost exclusively by nearest neighbor interactions. nearest neighbor photoreceptors or pixels in the visual field are used to calculate motion information. And I'll show you some experimental evidence for that. The problem is also mathematically tractable. It's, again, if you take the example of face recognition, it's very hard to write an equation or to write a function of how do you do that based on all these pixels that you measure. In the case of motion detection, that's a lot simpler, of course, and the problem is mathematically understandable. And last but not least, it's detecting motion, as I hope I convince you, is a very important thing to do for a fly that wants to fly around. So just to show you that at least in principle it's possible to write a mathematical model for motion detection based on visual input, let's symbolize the visual input by a contrast pattern that changes over space and time. And if the world around the fly moves, or the world around the camera, whatever, then if it moves at a time-dependent velocity, v of t, then contrast will have this space-time dependence. So it will depend on position minus the integrated velocity, of course. If you make that measurement, and at least to some approximation, the retina makes that measurement, it measures contrast as a function of space, and the photoreceptor signals will also vary in time. You can take two partial derivatives of that, which is the time derivative and the space derivative. The time derivative, through the chain rule, picks up this v in the integral. And so if you have the time derivative, the space derivative, and you divide one by the other, you recover that velocity, that time-dependent velocity. So if you were able to compute this ratio of two gradients, you can estimate velocity. Now, this is a mathematical model. This is not necessarily what you want to do if you're in the real world, but at least there's a solution to the problem of this wide field. I should have said that, I guess, wide field motion estimation. That's what we're going to look at based on visual input. So I now want to go to some behavioral experiments and neurophysiological experiments that aim at characterizing how motion is computed from a visual input stream. And I'm starting with a set of classical experiments by Hassenstein and Reichardt, who did this really beautiful and very patient neuroethology, and this was done 50 years ago. What they studied was this beetle, Chlorophanus. They put the beetle in a simplified world, which was a cookie jar. And the cookie jar had dark and white stripes on the inside. And so if you put a beetle in the center of the cookie jar and you start rotating the jar, the animal will try to follow the motion of the jar, will follow the motion of its surrounding. And that's actually, we have the two. So IMAX theaters, if you're in IMAX theater, you kind of have that tendency to follow these big wide field motions that are displayed on the screen. So that's a pretty universal behavior. That's interesting already. But in the case of this animal, they found a very very nifty way to quantify that behavior. So what Hassenstein and Reichardt did was take one of these beetles, tether it, and then give it a very simplified world. The world for this beetle consists of a couple of pieces of straw that are glued together, that are very light, so light that it keeps it in its hands, or feet, sorry, not to be too anthropomorphic. So the beetle takes the world in his hands, almost literally, and runs along this track, and then every once in a while, it has to make a decision to go left or right. So you put the beetle inside this, and you let it run its course, and you have your notebook, and you write down left or right, and every time it makes the decision. And then what you're going to do is to rotate the drum, you rotate it clockwise, counterclockwise, and in this way, You can quantify the response of the beetle, so you quantify its tendency to rotate with the stimulus. And now, if you have this quantification, you can do real science. So one of the things they did was to study how the response of this beetle varies as a function of contrast. This experiment was essentially something called the reverse phi experiment. I'm not going to go into the details of that. That's not very important for what I want to tell you now. But what they found was essentially that if you vary the contrast, then the response of the beetle, this turning tendency as they measured by the beetle making these decisions, varies as a parabola. So the turning tendency gets higher if you increase the contrast. If you step up the contrast by another factor of 2 from that, then you'll get a turning tendency that's about a factor of 4 higher. So the turning tendency of the beetle is a square function of contrast. And based on this experiment and a lot of other very nice and beautiful experiments, Reichardt formulated this model for motion detection. And this is called the correlator model or the Reichardt model of motion detection. And this was, as far as I know, at least the first real functional model, mathematical model of motion detection. This one? You mean? Yeah, then you have zero response. So this scale is different, and that's related to the experiment being a reverse phi experiment. So you should think of this as mean intensity, which is a half here, as related to some other defined intensity, which is a half. So if both are equal, then you get a zero response. And if you make this one equal to zero, then you have contrast. If you make that one equal to 1, you have contrast the opposite direction. Yep. So this was really the model that Reichardt formulated. It contains filtering by photoreceptors, contains temporal filtering, and it contains these two things, which are multipliers. And then it adds the result of those two things anti-symmetrically. But just to make things a little simpler, I've drawn this diagram, and this contains really the essence of what's going on. So there are two photodetectors. Think of them as neighboring photodetectors. An object moves in the visual field of these photodetectors, and it, of course, hits the first one first and the second one second. So there's a time delay between the blips that these two photodetectors see. If you now delay the input from this photodetector by an amount, delta t, that would correspond to the motion time going for this object going from there to there, then at the inputs to this multiplier that we saw before in the Reichardt model, you have perfect correlation. So you have coincidence, so to speak, between these two inputs, and you have a maximum output in your multiplier. If that condition is not met, for example, if this moves the other way, then you don't have that coincidence, and you don't see any output in your multiplier. So this, of course, is a motion detection with a fixed delay. You can make this delay soft by an exponential filter, for example, and in that way, you can embellish this, of course. But the main gist of this model is that you time delay or filter one signal, and you do a correlation operation by multiplication, for example, with a special element here. And of course, this model automatically has this C-squared contrast dependence, because if you increase the contrast of this object by a factor of 2, your photoreceptor here will give a signal that's twice as big, likewise here. And if you multiply them, you multiply 2 by 2 is 4, and you have your squared contrast dependence. So note that this is very different from the kind of mathematical model that I showed you before, this ratio of gradients, where you take the time derivative divided by the space derivative. That model didn't have this contrast dependence, for example. So this is a very different operation, it seems. So from here, I want to go to some experiments that we did ourselves. But I first want to show you that we are not much better than beetles in the sense that, we share some features with beetles in the sense that we are sensitive to specific correlations that you can induce in a pattern that are picked up by this Likert correlator model. So what's happening here is there are two panels with a red border and a blue border. And each of those panels will, if I switch it on in a little while, will display snow. So it will be just temporal white noise. It will also be spatial white noise. So all the pixels in the pattern are noisy independent of all the other pixels in the pattern. So they're independent over time, independent over space. So this red panel has an intensity profile, or an intensity as function of space and time, that I call I0 of x and t. And then in the other one, I'll put that same intensity fluctuation, same over space and time, but I'll give it a spatial offset, delta x, and a temporal offset, delta t. Now, if these patterns are far apart, you see noise in one and you see noise in the other, and there's nothing particularly interesting going on there. So if I start this demo, slowly these patterns will kind of merge together, and their delta x, the distance, the displacement is given by this delta x. If these guys get close together, I'll pause them for a while and they'll sit at that location. So this number first is 3 and then 2 and then 1, I think, and then goes into the negative numbers. If it's sitting at that location where delta x is relatively small, is a couple of pixels, then, and I add these patterns mathematically, so I just add the intensities on the screen, then what you'll have is a pattern that is I of x and t is the sum of the red and the blue, just because I add them. If you look at the autocorrelation, so I0 has an autocorrelation, as I told you, was independent random noise, independent in space, independent in time. So it has an autocorrelation that's the product of two delta functions, space and time delta function. But if you look at the autocorrelation of the total pattern, so this is the autocorrelation of only I0, only this part. If you look at the autocorrelation of I of x and t, which is the sum of those two, you'll get, the delta x delta t by this correlating with itself and that correlating with itself. But now you also get cross terms from this to this and from that to that. And that gives you correlations that exist at specific space-time offsets. So delta x delta t and minus delta x minus delta t. Those are, that kind of correlation is picked up very well by this Likert correlator model. And just to convince you, so you see these patterns are now at a big distance, and now they'll stop at 3. And I hope you see that you get an impression of motion. Now it's 2, so it's the velocity is smaller. 1, yet smaller. 0, you get noise again. And minus 1, minus 2, minus 3, etc. Everything moves in the other direction.
Have you ever played with the relative intensity?
Yeah. And that gives you roughly what you expect from a Likert model. So we did those experiments for the fly also. So the fly is actually very sensitive to these patterns as well. One interesting thing, and I don't have that here, I think, is you can also play with the intensity in the sense that you make the fluctuations in the second one, you give them a minus sign with respect to the first one. And if you do that, you'll see motion in the opposite direction. And that would also be predicted by a Likert model.
So this model, the receptor is here?
Yeah. Well, there are two different. So you mean what you see here?
On the previous slide.
Mm-hmm.
Is it two different
Yeah, it's in the fly. It's a little more intricate because the fly has a special neural arrangement where one direction of view is subserved by six omatidia, really. So that's a little tricky, but in essence, you can think of this thing as what, well, in the fly, would be called a neuroomatidium. And so that is a cell that is postsynaptic to the photoreceptors that gathers information from cells that look all at the same direction in space. And so if you have two of those neighboring cells in the fly, that's roughly what you're talking about here. No. Well, velocity, this calculation, it's a multiplicative calculation, is not done at that level. It starts to be done in the, so there's a level of lamina behind the photoreceptors, and then you get another big lobe, which is called a medulla, and it's thought that the first motion computations in the flight take place there. So it's a little more central. Okay, so as I said, you can play patterns like these also for the fly, and the fly motion sensitive neurons will respond to that very well. I'll give you an example of how fly motion sensitive neurons respond in a little while, but so you have to, in anticipation of that, you could look at this. So here, in this experiment, the delta x?
Yeah, so when you get them closer, at some point we start seeing motion.
Right.
So what, do you know what this delta x is in terms of the retina?
Yeah, that corresponds to, I forget the number now. It corresponds roughly to Braddock's short distance motion detection. And that is, does anybody remember?
I mean, because of delta t.
It potentially depends on both those things. Yeah, yeah. It could very well be that you have motion detection over. Well, so I can illustrate on this. So this plot illustrates the hexagonal sampling array of a fly, and you could have these inputs to the Likert correlator at different distances and maybe using different time delays. But in principle, that's possible. So this experiment, an experiment with a pattern like this, was done at different values of delta x and the minimum value of delta t that we could get in that experiment. And if you do that, then you find that if you look at how much response you induce in this motion-sensitive cell as a function of the position delta x, and we're working in two dimensions now, so we also have a vertical position, so delta x, delta y, then you see that the motion computation takes place mainly between nearest neighbors. So from here to there, and from there to there. That's where you, so you put your, the first, one input is here, and the other is here, or here. The problem, there's a concrete problem for the fly in this case, and that is, well, at least for this neuron that we're recording from, that's a horizontal motion-sensitive cell. And it has to calculate horizontal motion from a hexagonal input array. So that's a fixed input array. It's just the geometry of the omatidia. And there is no direct horizontal coordinate. The nearest neighbors are under an angle. And so what the fly seems to do is to just add contributions from those two. And it does seem not to compute motion over hopping over one more. It might do that at very low light intensities. And there are certainly indications that it does that. But at the light intensities we use here for these experiments, this is by far the dominant interaction. So that means that we can reduce the dimensionality of the problem, and that will become relevant slightly later. So I want to show you some experiments that are really in spirit the same as what Reichert did with the beetles, but now not with behavior, but with electrophysiological recordings. And fortunately, you can do that very well in the fly. I told you already, you can record from photoreceptor cells, and I won't talk about that here. This will give you just a quick overview of the fly, the visual input that's coming in through the lenses, focused there, transduced by photoreceptors, and then processed in the region called the lamina. And this is actually an illustration of what I was talking about, so that one direction in view is here subserved by these three omatidia. And because you have to think of two dimensions, in total there are six. And so signals from specific photoreceptors in these three cartridges are combined at this level of the lamina. So here you can record also from cells, from large monopolar cells, that look out through six different photoreceptors into the same direction in space. Okay, so the lamina is thought to do a lot of spatial and temporal filtering, but no real computation in the sense of strongly nonlinear interactions. That is supposed to happen in the medulla. Medulla is very hard to record from because the cells are very, very small. But fortunately for us, signals from the medulla are gathered by large field cells in a region called the lobular complex. From there, information is sent down through the neck, through the two region called the thoracic ganglion. And the thoracic ganglion is responsible for issuing motor commands to flight muscles and leg muscles. Yeah? No, well, it's in the medulla. It's embarrassingly little is known about function because they are so small. It's kind of chicken egg question in that sense. There are people, Axel Borst, for example, they're trying to use optical recordings to get more information there. Yes. So, first of all, the medulla and lamina as well, actually roughly the whole visual system, is very regularly organized. So it's organized in cartridges. So you have a direction of view here that maps onto a direction in the lamina, and that through optic chiasm maps onto a certain cartridge in the medulla, and that goes on until the lobuli here. And each of those cartridges has a kind of pretty fixed, as far as I understand it, a quite fixed structure. This is one of the reasons that Ramanan Cajal liked it so much. It looked like, he called it a neurocrystal, because everything was so regularly repeated. And each of those cartridges in the lamina, I think, contains about 15 cell types, roughly? Sorry?
Something
like that. Something of the order of slightly over a dozen. And in the medulla, it's 60 or 70 cell types per cartridge. And all of them are small. And so very few people have made recordings there. There are a couple of very short-term recordings that indicate that there's motion sensitivity there. And those were done by Defoe.
How might you figure out how the whole thing worked? Would you be so happy with it?
Maybe. Yeah, no, it could be quite true. Or smaller electrodes.
A cartridge in the medulla with 60 or 70 cell types, does it have multiple cells of each type?
I don't know the question. I don't know the answer to the question, I should say. I think it's pretty varied, yeah.
Something like 50 different cell types in a medulla cartridge. And I think it's very difficult to know whether the same cell type occurs two or three times, but there are certainly 50 different types. And there are also roughly the same number of interneurons have been identified which connect together different cartridges, but they
right.
cover several cartridges.
Yeah, that's typically.
So there are 50 different classes of lateral connection, roughly. I wouldn't say there's one lateral connection, but several for every 17 or so. So it's pretty complicated.
Yeah.
No idea yet where you Yeah, so the projections of some of them are quite well understood, like the T1 and T3 cells.
Right. Right. And so those are the output neurons of the medulla going onto the lobular plate. And those are thought to carry motion information, small field motion information. And I think I have the, yeah, okay, so this, of course, is the same you saw before, but in this level of the lobular plate, where these cells from the medulla project, you have a large set, 30-ish, 40-ish or so different cells. They all have very extensive arbors, and on those arbors they collect motion information. There are two main classes called V cells, and V cells because they detect vertical motion, and H cells that encode horizontal motion. CH is a kind of a combination cell that does something a little more complicated. But all in all, so roughly motion at this level is subdivided into horizontal and vertical. And then because these cells, or most of them, encode their information with spikes, each direction of view is at least covered by two cells, one going left-right and the other right-left, or up-down and down-up. Our favorite is the cell called H1. It's very easy to record from, even for a physicist. And one of the very nice features of H1 is that it picks up information here. This is the H1 that's sensitive to the left half of the visual field, the left eye. Picks up information there, sends it to the other lobular plate, the contralateral lobular plate, and inhibits CH there. The reason that this is so nice is that you can pick up the response, the spikes from H1, and the right half of the head. So you don't have to damage the left half of that, where it takes its input. And also, there's only one cell that does this. There's only one cell that is sensitive to horizontal motion going inward, which H1 is, so it's motion going this direction, and that projects to the contralateral side of the head. So if you record from a cell here, and that cell happens to be horizontal inward sensitive, then you know you got H1. It's a very nice feature, because now you can do very repeated experiments in different flies, and you see very much the same properties. Okay, so you make a little hole in the back of the head, go in there with a microelectrode, get it close to H1, and you'll find spikes. So this was literally a hand-waving experiment, as we heard that was kind of the Hubel-Weasel style also. So you wave your hand one direction, and then you wave it another direction. You get spikes from this contralateral H1, and actually in this case, you get spikes from the ipsilateral H1 as well, but they're very small. And that's when you wave the hand the other direction. So this is how the fly sits in the setup. It's sitting here. There's a blow up here. It has electrode coming into the back of the head, and the fly is sitting here staring at the screen. It has a feeding plateau here, which is important. We generally want to do very long-term experiments, and if you want to do that, you want to keep the fly happy. And so that means that in between experiments, we always feed it with sugar water. And in that way, you can keep it, well, with a little luck, you can keep it going for a week or so. Now, this doesn't seem to work. So this is what the fly is seeing. And I have this microphone here. So you hear the spikes from the fly as it looks at that screen. And you see that if the motion is left to right, you get a response. If the motion goes the other way, the response is spikes. And that's really the hallmark of a contralateral recording. So, what does H1 tell us about motion, and how does its response depend on contrast? So, it's a simple experiment you can do, and that is just move back and forth, as you saw in the demo, and do that experiment at different contrast settings. So if you have high contrast, then well, it's clear to you that you see motion very easily, and H1 will respond quite well. I'll show that in a sec. If you decrease contrast, it gets a little more difficult to see motion, and if you decrease it to its ultimate value of zero, you don't see any motion anymore. So, I mean, the question is moot, whether there's, it might move, it might not move. You can't detect it by visual means. So what is the response of H1? I'm just plotting here the firing rate of the cell as a function of contrast for motion of about, I think this was about 10 degrees per second. If the contrast is zero, you get a zero response. You get some spontaneous activity, but I subtract the spontaneous activity in this plot. So no motion-related response. If you increase the contrast, motion-related response goes up. And if you plot the rate as a function of the square of contrast, you'll get, as long as that value of the contrast squared is small enough, you get a straight line. And this is, of course, totally in line with the Riker model of motion detection, which predicted this quadratic contrast behavior. But if you increase contrast, the response kind of saturates. It seems that it doesn't go any higher than 120 spikes per second in this experiment. Of course, you can think, well, this is biology. H1 and the fly are not totally perfect, and H1 just can't transmit more than 120 spikes per second or so. So you can do the same experiment, but now do that at different velocities. And if you do that, and again plot the response as a function of contrast, you get curves that look like that. And they all plateau, but they all plateau at different levels. And that's a strong indication that this plateauing that we saw before, of course, is not related to saturation of the cell itself. If you splay these out and plot them in a three-dimensional plot, so here's contrast going from zero to maximum, here's velocity going from low to high, and you plot vertically the firing rate of the cell, you get a plot that looks like that. So at low contrast, it's blown up here. At low contrast, you get a quadratic contrast response, as we saw before. But as the contrast rises, you get this plateau. And this plateau, these plateaus lie at systematic levels, depending on what the velocity is. So if you're sitting here at low contrast, there's definitely ambiguity between velocity and contrast. So from the rate, there's an ambiguous relation between velocity and contrast. However, if you're here, then at least in this velocity contrast plane, that ambiguity is removed. If you know the contrast, you know the velocity. So in this region, H1 seems to act as more or less an unbiased, perfect, in quotes, velocity sensor, whereas in the low contrast region, its response seems biased by contrast. Yeah, Bart.
Where the fly is put in an environment with less than 0.1 contrast, does it? My bet would be that it wouldn't fly. Because
that it would not. I think it does fly.
What does it do? Because the system more or less seems to break down. I told you that it's very different.
Yeah.
Very low contrast.
Right. Well, I'm not sure if people did systematic experiments on natural behavior under those conditions. It's actually a good question. Might try that. People did experiments, the Reichardt group in particular, did experiments where they had tethered flies and they measured their optomotor response. And they certainly find things like that. They certainly find optomotor response at low contrast also. And they certainly find that quadratic behavior or some approximation to it. It's getting a little dicey to measure it there. And if you ask in general, for the problem of behaving under kind of low signal-to-noise ratio conditions, sometimes you're forced to. You have to. And what you do is, I think, and it's what we do too, you just do things more cautiously. So if you get up at night and it's dark, you want to have something from the fridge, you don't start running. You kind of move cautiously. So what happens is that, I mean, just because the physical signal gets worse, your signal-to-noise ratio lowers, doesn't mean you have to stop behaving. You just change the way you behave and you do things more slowly, etc. And I imagine that the fly would do that too, but I'm not sure. So to summarize this, what the fly does in these experiments on H1 is that if you have a low contrast environment, low contrast pattern, you're, in terms of velocity estimation, you're biased. You're a biased estimator. So the rate depends on velocity, but also on contrast. And that bias disappears if you go to high contrast patterns. You see, we saw that there the response is plateauing, and the plateaus are a function of velocity. So at this end of things, at the high signal-to-noise ratio limit, you're a more or less ideal velocity estimator. And just to bring the point home, this is roughly the correlation computation, of course. This, at least this is a hallmark of the correlation computation, where you have a multiplicative operation between two linearly filtered versions of the contrast. Whereas here, at this end, it looks more like this ratio of gradients that we saw in the beginning. If you want to calculate mathematically velocity, you take the time derivative and divide by the space derivative, and you have an estimate of velocity.
So how do you understand the beetle data? The beetle always does the thing on the left?
Well, the beetle data that I showed were taken at effectively a very low very low signal-to-noise ratio. It's a very small part of the visual field that was stimulated in these experiments. This was a reverse phi, essentially, where you look at two flickering lights. They did it with cardboard, but and that is a very low signal-to-noise ratio condition. And actually, subsequently, the Reichert group in behavioral experiments also found that the response deviates from strict quadratic behavior if you go to a higher contrast. That's a well-known fact. I shouldn't claim that this is a very new result. This in itself is a well-known fact. This one? Well, you can approximate these things by something like shunting inhibition, for example, could conceivably approximate an operation like that. Whether that happens in that form is not known. And in fact, the Reichert group has looked a long time for the physiological substrate of this and hasn't really found it. So that's still a bit of a mystery. There are other people working on that too, and there seems to be some progress. But I think the final word is not in. So we've seen that the fly computes motion. It seems to do it in a peculiar way. And this peculiar way is, well, it's biased in one setting of signal-to-noise ratio or contrast, if you wish. And it seems to be unbiased if the contrast is high enough. Now, the question is, the way the fly does this, is this in some sense the good way to do it? Is this the right way to do it, to have this bias at low signal-to-noise ratio and being unbiased at high signal-to-noise ratio? What signal-to-noise ratio is critical here? All those questions. So the question is there a right way to get from raw visual input to an estimate of motion? And of course, we've encountered a lot of problems in trying to think about that question already, and that, well, there's noise in the input, there's diffraction of finite sampling. There are also, in the real world, there are variations in illumination. I can show you an example of that. There are variations in contrast in the environment. If you move through an environment, then you may have big blobs or small blobs, bright or dark blobs. That's also a problem. There may be independently moving objects, other things that move in your visual field, and that will somehow, at least to some extent, will confuse any self-motion estimate. And then if you're a real animal, you're also moving from A to B, so you're translating, and so there are also translational motion components, which you have to separate from rotational motion components. So, summarizing, this is not a trivial problem. And so the question is not that easy to answer. we'll do here is to take an experimental statistical approach. So we're going to sample things, going to sample the relevant signals, and hopefully from that sampling we can derive at least some approximation to the right way of calculating motion from visual input. So let's set up this problem in a statistical way. What the brain needs to do is to estimate some feature from raw input data. And our feature here is going to be velocity, of course, and that's a time-dependent function. And the input, the raw input, is going to be, in our case, the time and space derivative of contrast. And I choose the time and space derivative of contrast because, well, we've seen in the mathematical model, the ratio of gradients, that that is a sufficient measurement. It's sufficient, at least in ideal condition, to calculate velocity from. So if you want to do that, if you want to estimate some feature from some input and you're working in a statistical framework, what you need to know is the probability distribution. And in this case, you need this conditional probability. So what is the probability of finding feature X given that the input is Y? And so we need to know this probability distribution, and we're just going to measure that. And the way to measure that is to build something. This is a little camera. It's very simple. It has 14 pixels, not the 5,000 of the fly's eye, but we have to start somewhere. So it has 14 pixels, and they're aligned in a horizontal row. The pixels are, so those are photodiodes, actually. So it's not a CCD camera. It's a photodiode array in order to get good signal-to-noise ratio in our measurement. And we read out that photodiode array in parallel at 500 hertz, a sample time of 2 milliseconds. As you see, this whole camera is mounted on a bicycle helmet. You can put that on your head, and you can move around in the world and take camera data with this little thing. Now, this is not enough, because what we want to know is not only the input. That's what we're sampling with the camera. We also want to know what the velocity is. And that's why this thing is here. So this is a gyro. This measures rotation along the vertical axis. And this thing is also sampled at 500 hertz. So we sample 14 pixels and a rotation along the vertical axis simultaneously. And we do that on a walk outside in the woods, or some approximation to woods, at least. So this is what we're sampling. And if you take a walk that's long enough, you get a lot of samples. You get a million samples or so. And if you have lots of samples of contrast and velocity, well, of course, you can do the temporal difference of contrast. That's easy. Spatial difference of these contrast values in the different pixels, that's also easy. And we've measured the velocity. So we have access to all these three things. And we have a lot of them. And if you have a lot of them, you can make a histogram. So if you then normalize that histogram, you have the joint distribution of time gradient and space gradient of contrast and velocity. So a histogram with three entries. From that, you immediately get to the...
Distinguish translational motion?
No. So we totally... we take what we get in.
And the gyro measures only rotation?
The gyro measures only rotation along the vertical axis of the camera. So the pixels are aligned horizontally, and the gyro measures this rotation. And yeah, we also don't look at external objects in the visual field. We take all of this as it comes along in well, roughly a natural sampling situation. Yeah. We see that, well, what you do is you make a measurement of light intensity, or a measurement, an A to D conversion of a photodiode signal. Sorry?
The velocity.
Yeah, both the velocity And actually, I've written contrast here, but light intensities. So you measure the light intensities in 14 pixels, and at the same time, the velocity along the vertical axis. And you do that 500 times per second while you're moving around. Oh, is that what you mean?
Yes.
Right. Oh, I'm sorry. Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
How many bins were you using?
I think in these it's 61. 61 for each direction.
And
I did just the dumb thing here. Use them equally, and you can be a little more fancy with that, but I didn't do that. Yeah.
60 over 60
over 60, 60. Yeah. If I remember correctly, that was yeah. I think so. And it is an issue. So what I did is to just take a long walk. So you fill up the bins that occur only rarely. No, not necessarily obvious. I mean, this is the lazy way of doing it. And you get a good piece of exercise if you walk along. Sorry? Sorry?
It's not really lazy. You walk quite a lot.
Really. Yeah, yes. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, it's within human capacity. It's not that bad. So, but yeah, it is an issue. So discretization is an issue. I don't think, well, if you choose, with 60 bins, you can make this work, more or less, I think. And I hope the results will show you that.
That's a statistician looking at estimate each of those density functions separately and then try to come up with a joint. So you do contrast mass, time, contrast in space, get distribution, and then make a joint.
No, that's specifically not what you want to do, I think. What you want to do here is to measure all of them simultaneously. Or is that not the question you're after?
Well, just wondering where the way to simplify. I mean, statistically, my understanding of statistics is the biggest thing is you always have problems with your sampling, right? Because you always have, you'll behave matrices. So the idea then is to get a distribution and try to estimate a joint distribution from simpler distributions.
Yes, but here in this case, it's crucial to measure the joint distribution. So you want to measure that, because if you do it that way, then you make an assumption about what the joint distribution looks like, and we're expressly that the whole point of this is not to make that assumption, but to measure it. So I think we're stuck to we have to measure it in this framework. Yeah.
The joint distribution of velocity and contrast that you see as a walker mm-hmm. is the same as those in the fly would see.
Yeah, and that's.
Because when you walk, right, there's a jerk.
Yeah, actually, you can see that in the camera motions, you see a little bit of that.
So you probably have some high frequency. I mean, the high velocity that the fly would see.
Well, I think it's. I mean, if you remember one of the first pictures I showed, these flies rotate at 2,000 degrees per second. I can't do that. That's really fast. So I think, if anything, I'll be a little slow. Well, I'm certainly slower than flies that chase each other.
Okay.
Whether a fly that flies more or less straight, that might be the same ballpark. And in fact, people have looked at fly flight, and if you look at the velocity distribution, that's the same order of magnitude at least as what we do here. That's I think I rotate my head. Standard deviation was 200 degrees per second or so. No, I haven't looked at that, and I think that would be hard to get out of these measurements, because if you go to higher orders of differentiation, I mean everything. So yeah, I haven't looked at that.
So even the lowest distribution, the velocity distribution is different. Then you look at right?
Sorry,
the lower order, just the velocity distribution.
Yeah.
It's the same.
The velocity distribution for fly and for me.
Yeah.
It's I don't want to put my hand in fire to say that it's the same, but it doesn't look terribly out of line.
So, I was going to ask, a lot of that depends on the kinematics of the movement, right? So flies have piecewise planar movement as they go, so they tend to, the difference between the vertical and horizontal component, which is crucial to the experiment, right? They go piecewise planar, or do they, are they jerky in the vertical versus the way you would do it, because humans tend to be pretty smooth.
Yeah, they tend to be pretty, and if flies fly, what we think is, if they want to fly in a more or less straight course, they also do that. But flies can make these very fast jerks. They can certainly do that. And that's not represented here, because that just goes too fast. And it's certainly something that I'd like to get into at some point, but I just haven't gotten to that. Yeah.
So you look around while you work?
Yeah, I just try to do...
Because your own behavior has an enormous influence on what that distribution is going to look like.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, but you do want to move. I mean, you do want to have some variation on the.
Yeah.
It's very hard to keep your head still.
Yeah.
If you move, if you walk around,
and
but.
You just have to look around.
What I did was just walk around as if I was normal, which is hard to do with a head like that.
Like,
Bill, you.
I think it's worth pointing out that you know there's a lot of literature that tries to talk about. Either the encoding of signal from the natural world or estimation of signal based on natural input. And theoretically, you always end up having to say, well, let's assume something. Let's assume that nothing's moving out of the world, so all I see is the flow of expansion associated with my forward motion. Mm-hmm. Or let's assume that the distribution of inputs is Gaussian, or let's assume it's of this form, let's assume it's of that form. And of course, you do this not without motivation from data, but it is always an assumption. So I think what's intriguing here is that while you can say, well, I don't particularly like the behavioral setting in which you did this, it's an attempt to just go out and directly sample all of the pieces of the distribution that are actually relevant to the estimation problem. And then you can, of course, do the same thing in different contexts. And I guess what's unique about the fact that you're looking at rotational motion is that if it's the rotational motion of the camera, you can put the gyro on the camera and you have an independent measure of it. Right. Where it's hard to get ground truth in real time for many other things. So if you want to do the problem of stereo vision, well, I guess you can take snapshots of the world and do some sort of ultrasound thing to find out actually how deep the objects are. Right? People try to do this, but it's not so easy to do that dynamically.
But
yes.
I mean, the key is the velocity distribution. If you get the velocity distribution here, flying through the fly, then it's a good approximation, right?
Well,
if it's not,
but
it's not
the question is the question is whether you think that everything that's being said here is only about flies.
Yeah.
If you do, then it's very important that you get exactly the distribution for flies. If you think that what's being said is something about the general problem of computing some visual feature.
Yeah, and that you have to take it in that spirit. It's that's certainly
true.
It's
also true that if you take the flywheels and show movies which have different velocity statistics, the computational ability to actually do that. So maybe you don't have to match it exactly, even if it's in flight.
Yeah, and I strongly suspect you don't have to match that exactly. And after all, what is the velocity distribution of a fly? I mean, one day to the next day, it's also different. So that's a very ambiguous thing. And so I think for this, if it's in roughly the right ballpark, then it's fine with me. And after all, we're interested in this. And a lot of the structure of the velocity distribution kind of cancels out in that. You're interested in the relation between. Well, you can go for the most probable velocity. In this case, I go for the conditional mean. That you can motivate that post after the fact. If the distributions you get out are reasonably peaked, then it doesn't make any difference. Then, I mean, then all these measures are essentially the same.
Right, but when it's not, it makes a
difference. Yeah, so you have to look. And so that's what we're doing. So you don't know, you're right, you don't know that ahead of time, but maybe you know that after the fact. And I'll actually show you that that seems to be borne out.
Yeah. So this assumes that there's no memory, right? So you're looking at a triplet as it gets...
That's a good point, yes.
So why not assume some filter which works over some small window of time, maybe it can change a lot your estimation?
Yeah, I didn't do that here because that is a hard problem. So I'm doing it here. I'm doing only kind of single snapshot motion estimation here. And I'm going to look at what its characteristics are. The problem you're referring to is if you start filtering, you have to have an idea of how to filter. And that in itself must be related to what the fly really wants to measure. And that's hard to get at this point.
But does one know how it's thinking?
Know how, what is
that? Instantaneous thing, I mean, does one know if there is a filter, how the filter is timing it?
There is a time limit on the behavior, which was this 30 millisecond behavioral time. And that's for total behavior. That's very long. The visual component of that must be a lot shorter because you have delays and you have to get your muscles, et cetera. And so, ballpark 10 milliseconds or so. So that,
yeah.
Yeah. I will. So we'll measure that, get the conditional distribution, and from the conditional distribution, which is a function of these input parameters, time and space contrast, gradient contrast, we can suppose you make a measurement of these two things. If you're an eye, you make a measurement of these two things. You want to calculate what the motion is, what velocity is. Then you can, we discussed this. So I'm just taking the conditional mean, and then we'll see if that's a good thing to do. So that's just the probability of finding velocity given those two optical input variables times v and integrated over all v. So this is a little piece of raw data. So this is a second in the life of the camera. The pixels are lined up vertically here. In reality, they're horizontal. So you have to flip that in your mind. The light intensity is depicted as a grayscale, as it should. So here, my head is kind of standing still. And here, at about 0.1 second, you see that there's a streak here, and that means that my head is moving in one direction. And then this object that was in the visual field kind of disappears here, and there's darkness, and then something picks up again, and a head motion decelerates again. Now, if you look at that array, you can take the time derivative of each pixel, and you can take the space derivative by just taking differentials, and you get 12 numbers there, because we have 14 pixels. So we have 12, we have a dozen space gradient points, and I'm plotting the values of that horizontally, and a dozen temporal gradient points vertically, and I put them on this space and time gradient plane as dots here. And each dot encodes, so to speak, a velocity. And the velocity value that it encodes is equal, in its gradient model, is equal to the ratio of these two things. So what you see immediately is that there's certainly a spread in what all these locations in the visual field tell you. And they spread around this red line. The red line is given by the gyro. And in this case, you also have an outlier because, space and time gradient are very small, and because there's noise in the measurement, this thing gives you just a very off-scale measurement. But so these are the raw measurements that you work with and that you calculate your probability distribution from. Just before I show you the results, just to get your mind set right, you can we're interested in a two-dimensional function. So z is a function of x and y. And you can plot a two-dimensional function as contour plots. So we have horizontal x, vertical y, and if you plot levels of constant z, then y will be z divided by x, and you get hyperbole here in this plane. So different levels of z, you have a different color of the hyperbola. If you plot y divided by x, then that means that y is z times x for some value of z, and if you choose different values of z, you get different straight lines through the origin. And if you choose this, which is a kind of combination of those two, because if you make x very small, then this term disappears and you just have x times y. But if you make x very big, then this term will dominate and you get y divided by x. If you do that, you get a kind of combination of those two. If x is big, radial lines, because you have that form, like this. But if x is small, you get something that's more reminiscent of hyperbolic radius. So this is the way in which I plotted the results here. So there's space gradient, time gradient, and this plane now shows you cuts, contour lines, through different values of z, or in this case, estimated velocity. So let's look at a couple of points here. If space gradient is zero, and the time gradient is zero, you have this point here. So both of them are zero. There's nothing in the cameras, it's just homogeneous light intensity, nothing changing over space, nothing changing over time. What would the velocity distribution be? Remember, this is a kind of collapsed version of a three-dimensional distribution. And you could think that in this axis vertical to the plane here, I have all these bins that are filled, and those bins represent different velocities. So if I pull out that stripe of kind of velocity probability that corresponds to this point, if I pull that out and plot that, I get this. It's the solid line. That distribution is the same as the stars here. The stars is just the overall distribution of velocities of how my head was rotating. Luckily, those two are the same. So this just means that if the camera is looking at something that has no structure, my head is not moving in a different way than if the camera is looking at, overall in the experiment. So in that sense, I'm not biased. If you now increase the space gradient, go to this green point, but keep the temporal gradient zero, what happens then is that this pair of points see a difference in light intensity, so that means there's a space gradient, but that doesn't change over time. There's no change over time. So what that means is, well, probably this camera is looking at something, is looking at some structure, but because it doesn't change over time, it's more likely that that the camera is standing still. It's not absolutely certain, but it's certainly more likely. And that's reflected in this green distribution. So the black distribution corresponds to that. The green corresponds to the fact that you have some structure in space, but it's not changing over time. And this tells you that you seem to be more confident now that you're standing still. And that makes a lot of sense. If you now go to the same space derivative, but to a high temporal derivative, either positive or negative, you see that the distribution changes to one where there's a velocity. So the mean of the red distribution or of the blue distribution is clearly different from zero. So your estimated velocity has some non-zero value here and there. So this was estimating velocity just based on single pixel pairs, and I just calculated this distribution from all the pixel pairs I have in the field of the camera over all time in the experiment. You can do also something that is a little closer to what H1 seems to be doing. H1 seems to be integrating velocity over a wide visual field, and we approximate that here by integrating velocity over our 14 pixels. Modest, but at least a step in the right direction. Yeah.
interpret a very large value of delta t to very small delta x.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yes. Yeah, you get. Yeah, I should have pointed that out. Yeah, I probably should do that, and maybe everything becomes white. But it's a good point. Of course, this is done by MATLAB, and it wants to produce closed contours, and so that's, and in fact. Of course, these regions are badly sampled. These distributions are the typical, they're very kurtotic distributions where you have a high peak. And so, okay. Those results, as I said, were for a single pixel pair, so a single elementary motion detector in Reichardt's parlance. And we now want to go to full field motion estimation. So. We had this example of the raw data before with all the different lines, all the different angles here that represent different velocity estimated by different pixel pairs in the visual field. What you can also do is to just draw the straight line that best fits these points, just linear least squares fitting. And that's the thick blue line here. So that you could think that the slope of this line is now the velocity that's represented by the whole visual array in unison. And of course, there's a little noise, but this is what the whole collection of visual input tells you. And if you want to do that, what you just do linear least squares estimation. What you want to compute is a ratio of x times y divided by x squared, where x is now the space derivative and y the time derivative. And so what I'm going to take in the next distribution is now this, and these brackets mean, of course, that it's averaged over the visual field. So I'm averaging space and time derivative, their product, over the whole visual field, and I'm dividing that or normalizing that by the space derivative squared, also average over the visual field. And I'm going to look at the probability distributions. I do a least squares fit because I want to have the best representation of. Sorry. Yeah, and it's probably not a Gaussian, and yeah, and I in this case I don't particularly worry about that. I just take it as it comes, and if you don't know the shape of the distribution ahead of time, it's. Right. Yeah, but you also have to know the error distribution, the shape of the error distribution as well, which I don't know, I think. So, yeah, you can argue that it's that you have to do something more sophisticated here, and perhaps that's true,
well, no, that's
but I don't want to do that.
The purpose of the error distribution.
So,
I thought that's the purpose of
the error distribution. Yeah, so if you measure the distribution, you can certainly do this. I mean, and you can see what comes out.
So and you can use best estimate of this giant distribution probability. You don't have to go to least square feet, probably distribution, so you can do better.
No, the probability distribution that I showed before.
So it didn't matter.
This one. This was a probability distribution that but the conditional distribution is conditional on time and space derivative of contrast.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's for all the points. Each point in the visual field could give you a different answer.
Okay.
And each point
so
in
the joint distribution of all the spatial derivatives as well as temporal derivatives. You just marry the joint distribution of one spatial derivative and time.
Well, and yeah, but I do that in. Do that with 12 in parallel because I have 14 pixels. So and I can use all of them separately.
Right. But
that's
you just didn't have the data of the derivative. I mean the full joint distribution with this 12 derived spatial derivative and time derivative.
Yeah, I do.
You do?
Yeah, well so what you directly measure Sorry?
It's a huge beam rooftop cable. Right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So but what you measure is, well, is directly this. This is the raw measurement. These are light intensities as a function of time. And so in your computer, if you want to calculate the space derivative, you take differences between neighbors. And time derivative, you take difference between neighbors and time.
But I mean, you have the problem with distribution in 13-dimensional space.
No. I have 13, I have 12 distributions.
Right, that's what I'm asking. If you have it, then you have
a joint distribution.
No, I don't have the joint distribution of the whole. I don't use the joint distribution of all of them separately.
Right.
I just lump them in this case.
Okay.
In this case, I get your point. So in this case, all these points are going to be entries into this three-dimensional distribution. Yeah? And because you're quite right, you can't do that. You can't do this. It's going to become a 28-dimensional distribution. So it's hopeless to sample that, of course. Can't do that. So here you use all these points and use them as entries in, to build up your histogram. Here, what I do for each time sample, I essentially have the best linear square fit. So, you calculate these two things. That's really what I'm going to do. But those are elements in the linear least squares fit. And so again, you wind up with a three-dimensional distribution.
I believe one can help you by saying that what you get from the previous picture is you know that you can make a very low dimensional spatial temporal derivative. You know what you can say about the velocity. Now what you're asking is you want to integrate. What's the right way to pull things together? And of course, in some sense, the answer is you need to weight the contributions of each of them by their error bars. And this simple scheme of drawing a picture and doing these squares, it can't be exactly right, but it captures the important thing, which is that what you don't do, perhaps surprisingly, is make local estimates of the velocity and average them.
Right.
Assuming only.
No, not assuming anything. If you do that, in almost any reasonable models of the distributions, you'll do very badly. And the reason is that, roughly speaking, the errors in estimating velocity locally are related to how big the spatial gradients are. If there isn't a big spatial gradient, you're very unsure.
And also depend on spatial gradient correlation. So the way you estimate this is that some dependent on the correlation is important with the correlation, right?
Sure.
So it's
also true that the form of the estimator you get here emerges as the theoretical optimum, even in cases where the distributions are Gaussian. But if you just stick to the data, the point is you have to find some way of deciding how to collapse things, right? And so one idea is motivated by this least squares thing. You could say, well, maybe you can do better.
Yeah, that's sure. I mean, and if it's drastically wrong, you'd probably see it in the results. And if it's somewhat right, you'd probably see it in the results too. And so, if you look at these, this is a plot analogous to what I showed before, but now it has these two entries in the linear least squares fit. So the space averaged square of the spatial gradient, and the space averaged, that's over all the pixels, average of time times space gradient. And so I plot those again and have a three-dimensional distribution just like we had before. This is, of course, is always positive, so it flips at zero. And again, the slopes of the lines would represent velocities here. So we can play the same game. If both of these things are zero, you get the same distributions. If you now go out and have a non-zero spatial contribution, so this term is non-zero, but you keep this term zero, then again that means that there's spatial contrast in your visual field, but there's no change in time, no change at least in this entry here. And that results in a probability distribution that gives you a very high confidence that you're standing still, which is the green one. And it's single peaked. So that's nice. I mean, in that sense, this is a justification after the fact. And if you go increase the temporal aspect of that signal or go to negative values of that, you get these distributions. And again, well, within errors, they're single peaked. So you estimate, what is it, 50 degrees per second here and minus 50 degrees per second there. What you also see, if you compare it to this, is that these distributions are much steeper. They're much better defined. So their velocities are much better defined. And that, of course, makes sense because you're now using the information from the whole array in a coherent way, so to speak. And that gives that improves your estimates dramatically.
Is it better than like 12?
I honestly haven't looked at that. So, well, I can calculate it. It's a lot better. We also want to compare these things to what the fly does. So,
are you going to show us comparison of the velocity and gyro?
No. Well, that's essentially that's this. So that's that. So the gyro gives you, well, by assumption, the gyro gives you the perfect estimate. And if you have some space-time, some optical measurement here, then you get a distribution. And that gives you the spread of your estimate around what the perfect value would be. So yeah, implicitly you do that. You also want to hook up to what the fly tells you, to these fly experiments that I showed before. And remember that what you have here, these lines are a contour map. So they give you a mapping from input visual coordinates, so to speak, to some estimated velocity. And what I can do is for this map, which is, in a sense, well, by definition, in a sense, the optimal estimator for natural motion, my head motion, in a natural environment, I can play something like a sine wave. That's going to be something that's easy to compare to an experiment in the real fly. So if you play a sine wave out for that thing, then these, and you'll trace out something in this optical plane, that's this thing, and you read out velocity values. And if you do that over time, you get that. If you average them, you get an estimated velocity. And if you do this thought experiment or this computer experiment as a function of contrast of the sine wave and velocity of the sine wave, you get a map that looks like this. So again, stimulus velocity, contrast, you increase as a function of contrast and then you plateau, whereas as a function of velocity, you kind of keep on coding it the right way. And that corresponds, at least qualitatively, to what the fly does as well. So this measurement, this direct measurement of natural light intensities and deriving directly by brute force, or by directly looking at the distributions, deriving the velocity estimator from that gives you at least qualitatively the same result as what the fly gave us. And that's an interesting thing that might give you pause to think that the fly might try to do something like that as well. Try to approach optimality as well. Intuitively, why we get the the dependence on contrast disappears if you have it is ultimately it's the structure of the distribution that does that. Sorry?
If I do your first method with pairs.
Mm-hmm. You get that too. You get that too. Yeah, you have to visualize the distribution in three dimensions. It is a reflection of the structure of the distribution, of course, ultimately.
So you said those contour plots are a straight line, or a fan of straight lines. Then you have a velocity of the
If they're high enough, you get there.
Contrast required.
So if you're kind of here, contrast above that, then you're in a region where you kind of lose that contrast dependence.
Okay, so I just become more peaked, you say.
So that lower contrast, this block on the corner is kind of hill top, going to move down out to have more space in this block, right?
At lower contrast,
this hill top going to move downward, collapse the more space.
I'm not sure if I follow that. This plot? No, this is a function of contrast, or spatial gradient of contrast and temporal gradient of contrast. And so I have all, in a sense, well, modulo the fact that I'm plotting this in 61 bins and along each direction, you have all the pairs, all the occurrences of space and time gradient of contrast that you can get.
No, I thought this curve of the flight ladder is based on mean contrast, not for the instantaneous.
The curve for the fly you measure, yeah, that's...
That's a different thing.
Well, no, that's... But individual pairs of photoreceptors in the fly's visual field will be exposed to that. They will see that amount of contrast if they're on the contrast border. I think that's the same thing. Maybe we can go to a next experiment that might make it a little clearer. Yeah.
Well, I just had a question once again, just to make sure I understand the main point. So one was that basically the optimal readout of the velocity should be when you spatially average and you pool all the velocity estimates, they should be dynamically weighted by how much spatial contrast there is, right?
Yeah, that's what's happening here.
That's
yeah.
The dynamical one. And then the second question was the reverse of the other question, which is intuitively, why is the optimal filter the one that actually is biased at low contrast? Because you want to sample the ones with greatest spatial contrast, I mean, is an artifact? Why? I don't understand.
If you go to low contrast. To very low contrast,
yeah, why?
You're getting. Suppose we go back to this first mathematical model where you take the ratio of space or time and space derivative of contrast. Mm-hmm. If you imagine what happens if there's noise in your signals, well, first of all, you take derivatives, which is usually a bad idea if there's noise, and then one of them is in the denominator, and so if you have zero crossings there, they're at arbitrary places, and they'll just totally blow your estimate away. So you have to protect against that happening. And that's why, at low contrasts, you have to do something else. You cannot do this straight ratio of these two things.
But itself, this estimate is not the real estimate, right? It's just
a
construction with certain assumptions.
You build
this.
Which one do you mean?
Total joint velocity.
No. That's true. It is.
It's not in the statistical sense.
Well, it's the best estimator based on the data that I have here. I think you can say that. It's not, and that's quite right. It's not the best estimator in the 14 times 2 dimensional space. Yes. I have pre-collapsed these things, but they're guided, well, first of all, by the fact that you can work with spatial and temporal derivatives, because those are the only ones that really carry any motion information. Then by the fact that you want to estimate wide field motion. And so if you want to do that, you can collapse again. So that is the reason. Well, I think it's still reasonable, but yeah, it's not the really large dimensional space. But I think these steps in dimensional reduction are at least reasonable.
So although... The flight doesn't have access to this huge table either.
Yeah, you don't think... Yeah, sure.
Just like
right. You don't think that the fly has in its head and this gigantic lookup table. The fly would have 5,000 dimensions, and so, and the fly must also do it by computation online. So, yeah.
To what extent is the improvement in your velocity estimator with increasing contrast dependent on the fact that high contrast are much less infrequent than natural scene?
That high contrast are.
So there's very few ways in which a high contrast can get from one point of the image to the other point of the image, other than moving from A to B, because high contrasts are very uncommon. Whereas low contrasts are quite common, so there are lots of different patterns of movement that could shift the low contrast from one set of pixels to another.
Yeah, although, I mean, within the limits of sampling this at 2 millisecond intervals, etc., this is a continuous motion. This is a continuous measurement of contrast fluctuations. And
so it really is an order.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I'm not quite sure what you mean by a high contrast having less. I mean, if you have a high contrast in your visual field and you move this camera around, then you'll scan it over the visual field. And it's not going to suddenly disappear or so. But those episodes, of course, that you have high contrast in the field are relatively rare. And so that's one of the reasons why these regions here are undersampled. There you get sampling problems in that region. And that's the way that problem will manifest itself, that you just get undersampled in that region of the distribution.
Yeah,
okay.
Rob, you're getting kind of close to the time.
Right.
Are you
getting
your slides?
Well, I'm halfway through. No, that's not true. I can wrap this up in a couple of minutes, I think. You can play this whole game at higher or lower light intensities if you want to, and you don't need to go outside for another walk, and that is because we understand photon shot noise really well. This is just Poisson process. You can do this in your computer. So you can add noise to your sample data in a way that you understand physically, and you can do all these measurements again, or try to construct these optimal motion estimators. And then you can also do an experiment on the real fly and give it a very small strip to look at that's 14 pixels wide to kind of compare more quantitatively what this camera data gives you versus what the fly does. And you can do that experiment at different light levels to decrease the signal-to-noise ratio going to lower light levels. So this is what the fly tells you, or what the rate of H1 is under different light intensity conditions, going down and down and down as a function of contrast. And this is what the camera tells you, that the optimal estimated velocity is. And though these curves don't totally overlap, you see that there's quite some similarity in these two curves. And this similarity is, there's no fitting parameter, so to speak. This is model independent, save for the assumptions that we made in doing this analysis. So this, again, makes you think that this optimal motion estimator that we found by sampling and the fly are really closely in the same ballpark in estimating motion from in noisy conditions. So we've seen now that optimal velocity estimators compute biased velocity estimates, especially at low signal to noise ratios, and the fly has something similar, which is suggested that it tries to do optimal computation in different signal to noise environments. And they combine the behavior of two well-known models of motion detection, which is this Reichert model, on the one hand, derived from insect work, and the ratio of gradient models. Now, you can still ask whether all of this is relevant to a fly in real life. Because maybe if you're out there and you're a fly, and maybe the signals are so good that all of this is totally irrelevant. So in the last 3 minutes, I'm going to take you very quickly through this. You can literally do something like that in an experiment outdoor. So we have a fly put on a rotation axis. We can record from it while we spin it, and we spin it in a way that's reminiscent of these chases that I showed you before, the Lennon-Collett experiment. And if you buy big batteries, you put them in here, you can power this whole experiment independently from from the power grid, independently from 60 hertz noise. That's also nice. And so you can do this experiment outside. And, well, this is roughly what the fly would see. It's being rotated around in a pattern, as I said, that's at least representative for these chases of flies. And here, just like Terry Znofsky showed yesterday, I show a raster, in this case of 20 repetitions of the same rotational stimulus. And you see that the spikes, well, here the spikes are suppressed because the motion is negative. Here, the motion is positive, and you generate lots of spikes. Here, in these 20 trials at least, you get reproducibly two spikes in response to this little blip of positive motion. Now, there's a little bit of variation in the timing of the spikes, but by and large, it seems pretty reproducible. Now, you can do this experiment also at different times of day, and nature gave us a big lamp that goes out at the end of the day. So if you do the experiments at noon, at around, this was around 2 o'clock, so call that noon, half an hour before sunset and half an hour after sunset, you see that, noticeably just by looking at it, you see that the spike train gets much more irregular. And this is about the time that flies call it a day. This is when they kind of stop flying around and behaving. So you see that under, well, by definition, these are natural conditions, natural variations in light intensity, that you see quite profound effect on spike timing regularity. Yeah. Yeah, delay is also changing. So one part of that is there's an effect of temperature. Temperature was going down in this experiment at the end of the day. I later did experiments with where the fly was sitting in a bubble at constant temperature. And so then the delay is a little less, but still you also introduce delays because the visual system gets slower if the light intensity goes down. That's a well-known effect in photoreceptors already. Okay, so this summarizes what you saw before already, that spikes get placed more accurately on the time axis if the light intensity increases. So this is a precision of about 0.6 milliseconds. If you look at the precision from one spike to the next specific spike pair, you go to 100 microseconds precision or so, and that's the limit of what we can measure. Yeah. Well, you can respond to single photons, but if there are less photons around, then there's more noise. So you can build a very sensitive system, and the fly does that. You can measure single photon responses, but still, if the flux of single photons is low, then you have a low signal to noise ratio. So you can't get around that. Can give this an information measure, which I won't talk about. This is interesting because you see, if you do this experiment in the daytime and there are clouds moving across the sun, you get light intensity variations, about half a log unit, and those have a noticeable effect on spike timing also. So in the real world, there's more interesting things going on than in the lab. This is not spike timing precision, but spike time delay. Yeah. So if the light intensity increases over this kind of half log unit like because of the clouds, you'll already get a noticeable change in spike time by about 2 milliseconds or so. And last experiment, if you put a fly on this rotation stage, but in a inhomogeneous environment where there's a light spot here, and you do this experiment starting 600 seconds before sunset, and then following it until about an hour after sunset, what you see is something very interesting. So here, the spike patterns are tightly lined up. There's a lot of light. Here, they're getting fuzzier. And at the really low light levels, you see that there's this striping going on. This is another manifestation of bias. So what was happening in this experiment, this was a wrong experiment. I intended the fly to rotate every time with zero DC velocity, and that didn't happen in this experiment. So the fly, every rotation it made, was slowly precessing through the visual field around it. And that meant that it's in some portions of this raster, it looked at high contrast and some portions at low contrast. And you see that is reflected in the spike timing here when the signal-to-noise ratio is low, but not here when the signal-to-noise ratio is high. And again, this points out that also in natural conditions, your estimates will be biased by the structure of the pattern that you look at if your signal-to-noise ratio goes bad. And that, this is just to explain the same thing. This is to put it in words, I think. And, this is the plans for the future. You want to do this camera from one dimension to two dimensions. You want to calculate or sample maybe in three rotational axes also. Ultimately, you also want to take translation into account, etc. And we might also want to move the fly, not only on the rotation stage, but on something like, what's this called? Well, go take it to Six Flags. So have a good lunch. This is from a very cruel book. This is one of the mildest pictures in the book. Tony.
This is a kind of a general question, doesn't relate to what you're doing, but like a lot of experimental neuroscience. So I think the problem I have with estimating parameter that experimenter is thinking about, that I think that photoreceptors are talking about photons, and spikes are talking about spikes, and all the other things that we talk about, like orientation, tendency, velocity, joint angle, pose, anything that experimenters can measure, these are things that people talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And of course there's a correlation between these two things because people are made of neurons, right?
Partly,
but,
yes.
But I just think that possibly this whole paradigm could be, do you think it's possible that we could reject the whole paradigm and still produce an unconscious nervous system at the low level where the things which are talking about the things that they're actually hearing as opposed to the things that's in the experimenter's head?
Man, this is a it's a very difficult question to answer.
Yeah,
sure.
It's a valid question.
Yeah, sure. But it is of course true that all the experiments you do are with some model of or some function in mind of the system that. So we've made some attempts to at least be a little less direct about that question, and that's this. Bill and I have been working on an experiment where what you try to do is to give the fly some random input and record from this neuron, and then reconstruct what it picks up out of that random input, and then you see that's not a big surprise. It's motion related, but you do it in a way that doesn't force you to analyze it in terms of motion. That is something that drops out. So in principle, and in practice it's much more difficult often, but in principle you could, do the ultimate white noise experiment and or show all the pictures in the universe that could ever exist in a million pixels and just hammer the animal with that. And then record from the spike train and try to correlate that. That would give you, in principle, a more or less model-independent way of finding out what the neuron does. I don't think in practice it's a very useful approach,
right.
Unless you specialize and you have to do.
I agree that it's really hard to know what to do if you take that point of view in terms of an experiment.
Right.
It's still, that in itself still stands as a
dilemma. No, I think this is a very important problem in neuroscience. I mean, one of the biggest problems in experimental neuroscience is that any idiot can record a signal.
Right.
Correlate it with something else that's going on.
Right.
And the numbers of different ways in which that correlation could be established is infinite.
Right.
And neuroscientists have actually developed quite a lot of methods for trying to get around this. One of the most effective is to try and drive the neuron to see if you can
change behavior. People have done that a lot of these are open theory systems, you've actually done it in monkey entities as well. So by biasing the response for cell injecting current, you can change monkeys' behavior, the probability that it makes a behavioral decision, and they will work. Another method you can use is to actually try and work out whether neurons are connected or what other neurons they're connected to, and reconstruct the pathway so that you actually have the whole thing given away. Another way is you can eliminate the neuron by blocking its response chemically or killing it or whatever. So, I mean, this is a very serious problem, but we try to get to grips with it. But there are still too many people in the world who show a monkey a picture, record a response from the frontal cortex, and then say that response is telling you something about how the monkey processes the picture. Well, it just tells you that the frontal cortex is, you know, connected to the arm.
Yeah, like that neural.
Yeah. Right. Okay, guys, kept you long enough from looking. Oh, you wanna?
Yeah. So when a fly is flying, you use the make it fly like you bicycling around.
Oh, I didn't do that. Well, I didn't bicycle actually. I just walked around. No. Let's see. But the closest. I actually did experiments where I replayed that velocity trajectory in the lab, but not. I didn't do it in the wild. No, that's a good. Yeah. We've been thinking about doing that experiment also outside. And then, but then you want to compare it to the camera. So you want the fly to see the same visual field as the camera, and then, so you have to make a very small slit through which the fly looks, and it has to rotate at high speed also. We haven't gotten to that. We hope that we can do similar experiments, but now with a two-dimensional array, 61 pixels, and then that becomes a little more meaningful and a little easier to do also. So I think we're, well, hopefully going to do that within the next year or so. Any more questions? Well, I'll be around for the rest of the day also. Thanks.